Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store if you feel inclined. So check it out. Our guest today is Claire Pelletier. Claire graduated from North Carolina State University in 2018 with a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Sciences and a Marine Science concentration. While at NCSU, she participated in the semester at CMAS program at the Center for Marine Sciences and Technology in Morehead City, where she was first introduced to undergraduate research through a project investigating blood gas levels after capture in Black Sea bass. For two summers, Claire was a Patricia McClellan Green Summer Fellow at CMAST, where she worked on projects looking at site fidelity in mummy chog and discard mortality in dolphinfish. After graduating, she worked with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries, investigating the accuracy of different reproductive histology methods. Before joining the SHARF Lab at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington in 2020 as a master's student. Her research explores the next phase of non-native catfish research by applying DNA barcoding to improve prey fish identification, using telemetry tagged individuals to identify seasonal movements, and estimating catfish maturity schedules and fecundity. Welcome to the podcast, Claire.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for coming on. I'm really excited to hear more about what you've been up to, because it's been a bit since I've seen you, I guess, with the whole pandemic and everything. So good excuse for me to catch up and also, you know, just kind of showcase all the stuff that you've been doing, because it sounds like you've been busy.
I have been busy. It's been a lot.
Yeah. But I guess before we get started, I'd love to just like reel it back and ask you kind of what got you interested into fisheries, since, you know, I think people come at it from different paths and it's kind of fun just to hear what gets people into the field.
Well, I grew up on the coast of North Carolina. So to be honest, even as a kid, I was always playing on the shoreline or in the waterway and basically catching whatever I could, like whatever I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
And then when I was a teenager, my dad got into sports fishing out in the Gulf. And
yeah.
So that was kind of my first experience with the big fish, you know, the big trophy fish. And I loved them. But for me, it wasn't so much about the fun of catching them. I was kind of more sitting on the sidelines going, oh, what's that fish? Like, is it the right time of year to catch it? Why did we catch it? And so I always kind of had a fascination with that. But when I went to state, I'd actually planned to pursue water quality just because I thought it had more, probably a little bit more job security. So in my head, I'm like, you know, like marine biology can kind of be a hobby. It's something that I can kind of enjoy on the side. But my sophomore year, the semester at CMAS program through NC State was introduced. It was just basically, it was too tempting to pass up. And I tried to stay away from it just because I, you know, I was hesitant to go just because it was so specific. And I was a little bit afraid to leave state, you know, like leave all my friends.
No, that makes sense. It's kind of a big jump. And I mean, especially if you're still at that stage where you don't totally know what you want to do yet, you're like feeling things out, that can be a kind of a big like, oh, I'm gonna go, you know, stay somewhere else and like take classes on the coast and do something totally different. It feels kind of crazy.
It did feel crazy. And I was, you know, and I was so hesitant. And it felt like such a big commitment at the time. You know, but I got pretty lucky because the head of my department, this really nice man, Dr. Winner, he knew how obsessed I was with pretty much everything ocean, everything fish. And he basically took me aside. He was like, you need to be honest with yourself. You need to be honest about what you really want.
Yeah.
It was a very serious conversation for sophomore year. But he was right. So I went, and I still kind of thought, you know, like, I'll go, but I don't think this is going to be my career path. But after working with these absolutely amazing people, I mean, you know them, they're the sheer amount of just brain power and don't know, just overall experience and amazingness in that field and that one.
No, exactly. Building. It's like a unique community. I feel like at, you know, marine labs or the marine facilities for universities, you'll get fun groups of people just because they're all so interested and so knowledgeable that it's, you know, you're kind of immersed in it, I guess. And there's also just fun. It's like a cool place to be. So I think I kind of understand that feeling where you're like, oh, well, this is cool and new. It gets you excited about you know, the field in a new way.
Yeah, I mean, it was so new. And honestly, I didn't really know that it was like an option for me to have a career like that until I saw these amazing people doing it. And after that, I was hooked. I just knew I wanted to do something
Pun
similar.
Intended. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was sort of in the same boat. It's like, because no one tells you, oh, yes, there are people who study fish for their job.
Yeah.
That's not something that is explained. So it's cool when you see it actually in action. It's like kind of mind blowing, I think, at first. Like, wow, you can get paid for this. Sweet.
Oh, it really is. I mean, like in no career day in my elementary school days, did someone ever show up, you know, holding a shark? I don't know.
Yeah. No, I wish.
I know.
Yeah. In Ohio, it was just like, you will be an engineer or you will be an architect or you will be a business person. And I'm like, okay, cool.
Yeah. It's really cool when there are options that you didn't even know you had. And then they're, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It feels like a whole new world opens.
Yeah. After that, you probably kind of dove into research a little more head on. So I guess now is a reasonable time to start getting into what your past research actually was, unless you have more that you'd like to talk about about the semester at CMAS, because I'm sure they had you guys doing pretty cool stuff there too.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds great. It actually, it kind of starts off still at CMAS.
Yeah. Sweet.
So we got a good
perfect
transition.
Segue. Love it. Thank you for making that work for me.
So my first experience with undergrad research was when I was doing the semester at CMAS, and it was actually looking at the differences in blood gases that were dependent on the capture or the depth of capture and the method of capture in black sea bass.
Very cool.
It was really cool. And that was actually, it was the first research project I've ever done. So it was a little bit, you know, trial by fire. But I was very lucky to have such a great mentor when I was doing it. It was definitely more, I guess, centered in anatomy than anything else I had ever done.
Yeah.
So it was really different than anything else I'd ever done, but I really loved it. This was also a project where I had to remove conger eels from fish traps on like a daily basis. So that was my first experience with like scary sea life, which was so fun. But no one ever tells you when you start a project like that, that like, hey, there are going to be these eels that like might take off a couple fingers.
Just some surprise bonus excitement for you.
Yeah, pretty much. I also learned how to take blood from a live fish. So it was a really cool project.
Where do you, I guess I have two questions. First, who were you working with on that one? I'm not sure.
It was Dr. Craig Harms.
Okay, awesome. And then I was also curious, I guess, when you were drawing their blood, are you taking it from their gills? I think we've done that a few times in my lab to like look at hormones and gag and stuff, but I'm curious how you got the blood out of the fish.
So I don't remember the actual names of the vessels, but basically we worked around the tails, like around the caudal.
Oh, okay, cool.
So we could either turn them on their side, and like right along the center of the caudal, there was a pretty big vein there that we could tap into, or we could go in ventrally, again, close to the caudal, and we could tap into it that way.
Yeah, that's so cool.
It was really cool. It
took so much practice. You're like a fish nurse. I bet. That's like a real skill. I'm impressed. I have such shaky hands. I don't know if I could do that, honestly.
I think I got it really right about two times. All the rest is attributed to Dr. Harms.
Love it.
He was the expert at it. But he did try to teach me, and he did teach me.
I mean, he's had some practice, so like, you know,
definitely.
It's all right.
Definitely. There's a reason he's better than I am, but but it was fun to try.
Yeah. No, that's so cool. And I guess I probably should have asked this earlier, but was there sort of a question of interest, or like what was the rationale behind looking at their blood characteristics?
So it was mainly seeing, I guess, how stressed they got. So if there were like more stress chemicals released, if they were caught from deeper water versus more shallow water, and if there were different chemicals released. Basically, the two types of capture that we compared were using just fish traps, like off a dock. And then we had some people just reeled in by hook and line just to see if the stress hormones would be different.
Yeah, different between the two. Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah, that's like such a neat first project. Drawing blood from fish.
You can see why I got hooked after it. Like,
yeah, exactly. I feel like I would definitely be into that. Man, yeah. I mean, CMS is such a good way to get introduced to this stuff.
Yeah, they're actually a pretty nice first fish to work with too, just because they were, I don't know, I feel like they're a worse fish that could be your first
fish. No, that's true. I mean, they're like neat looking, and I guess they're, you know, reasonably convenient to catch, which is nice. It's not like you have this like crazy debacle to get any of them, which is good.
Yeah.
And I guess how big were the ones that you were getting? Just like, you know, a couple,
they were
half a foot-ish or something.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
Like I know that we are on a podcast and you cannot see my hands.
Yeah, no, exactly. Podcasting is a visual medium in my mind. I'm always staring at stuff, but I'm like, that's not
well, I'm looking at you and I'm holding apart my hands, but you're right, probably about half a foot.
Yes. Yeah, I can attest. That looks like half a foot to me.
Okay.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, those are just, they're, I think, fun because you can just, you know, off any dock or whatever, just catch a few of them. I know the last time I was in North Carolina, I caught plenty just because I was like fishing randomly for fun off a dock.
Yeah, and I think they're pretty fun to catch, you know, like they put up like a decent enough of a fight.
Yeah, but, I mean,
you know,
for their
don't
size,
lose an arm
like,
while you're bringing
they're
them in.
Saying, hey, I don't want to go up there. Yeah, so that's awesome. And it is there. It is something nice about having a fish that's like reasonable to wrangle. Because I mean, I feel like working with gag for me has been pretty easy, but they're also, they tend to slap around sometimes. It can be kind of difficult. And then in my time at CMAS when I was working on cobia, that was a whole thing, because those are some muscular fish. They're like, we don't want whatever you're trying to do to us. You're not allowed to acoustically tag me, no sir.
Yeah. Oh gosh,
it was crazy. I would not have been able to draw blood from them, that is for sure. Impossible.
Oh gosh, no, I mean, like with my current work with catfish, I went in very cocky about how strong I was compared to how strong a catfish was. You know, because I saw shows where people go noodling and I'm like, I could do that. You know,
yeah,
you kind
like,
of have this
easy.
Yeah, like on. You kind of had this false sense of confidence. And then the first time I got one on a boat and it's just, you know, like 40 pounds of pure muscle thrashing around.
Yeah. Different story.
Your ego gets like, knocked down a few pegs.
Maybe I need to rethink this noodling thing. I should have tried it out. So funny. Yeah, that's quite the change. It's a big fish right there.
Well, also from Mummy Chog, if you want to talk about
true. Those. Yeah, I do want to talk about Mummy Chog.
So basically, this is when I did the Patricia McClellan Green Summer Fellowship. I felt really honored to get it. I was really just blessed to get it. But I ended up working in Jeff Buckle's lab, and Paul Ruderhausen was my mentor.
My best. We love Paul.
I know.
Very fun to work with, for sure.
So fun to work with. Yeah. I feel like half of my funny stories involve the projects that I did with him.
Mm-hmm.
So for that project, I looked at site fidelity in Mummy Chog.
Yeah.
So basically what we did was just we batch tagged a bunch of mummy chogs using elastomer tags.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to learn how to use like the elastomer under the skin, which was really cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was really fun to learn.
Helped out a little bit. I think they have some ongoing work, like looking in like culverts and stuff at the mummy chogs and elastomer tagging them. So I helped out with that a little bit while I was there. Just randomly. I think it was because they needed just someone else, because it was mostly like Jeffrey Merrill handling everything, and he was like, I need an extra buddy. So I was like, I'll help. And that's one of the experiences that made me like Mummy Chog so much. So it's kind of cool. I'm like, that's neat that we were doing at least the same technique. It's fun. But it's also, they're slippery little guys, man. Don't try and get away from you.
Oh my gosh, yes. But no, we were actually doing the same thing.
Yeah, is that a continuation of that project?
Mm-hmm, yeah, oh, yeah. Just
that's a so cool. Wait, okay.
I know, I didn't know we worked on the same thing.
That's awesome, yeah.
I love it.
I had a blast with that, though. I'm glad that I was able to help. I feel like, ooh, part of
it. It was so much fun.
That's awesome.
But yeah, we were basically just trying to see if culverts and streams disrupted the movement of the mummy chog to different sites. So basically that was my first experience with a mark recapture survey. Mm-hmm. And I believe we actually found out, at least when I was there, that the mummy chog were pretty attached to the sites where they were initially caught. They were pretty loyal.
That's really interesting. I mean, yeah, I guess when I was helping with that, we did get a good number of recaptures, but I wasn't sure if anyone had, kind of looked through it more holistically yet, or tried to draw any trends other beyond just like looking at it on the data sheet. But that's cool to think about. I wonder what the journey for the mummy chog is like. That's what I was thinking about after tagging them and throwing them back. I'm like, I wonder what they get up to, because I was curious. I'm like, maybe they do just hang out in the same spot, or maybe they go pretty far and come back. I don't know.
I mean, I'm kind of curious about it too. You're right, they really are really, they're a little fish with a big personality.
It is true.
Actually, before we started tagging them, my first job that summer was going into the marshes and trying to catch like very post-larval versions of them.
Yeah.
And that was really fun. It was crazy because you have no idea how many times I came back like covered in mud.
Oh, I bet.
Or just like falling in random pools and marsh water. But it was very fun.
Accurate. Yeah. I know. Definitely didn't get into, fisheries to be glamorous, that's for sure. Well, cool. Is there anything else to cover on the mummy chogs? I want to make sure that we don't, move past them too fast, because they are so cool. And my favorite fish.
They are so cool. I don't think so. I feel like I mostly just have fun stories involving mummy chogs. I don't think.
Yeah, so exactly. Very fond of them. Spent plenty of time thinking about them. That's a very fun sea mass project, though. I would enjoy that for sure.
It was a really fun project. I learned a lot about catching them, which was it was very interesting to catch them, because I basically just go into like these little abandoned creeks and set up, minnow traps with a menhaden.
Yeah.
And I always found it really interesting, because in some traps you'd get hundreds,
Mm-hmm.
Could barely count them all.
crazy to me some of the sites when we were pulling up the traps, and it would just be full of mummy chugs. And then some places they just weren't that interested. It's really,
I know. Yeah. And then you'd pull up a trap that would have like one in it.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is too, just to like put it in a time scale, it's like, you know, we only soak them for like a night or something, and then yeah, you know, you come back the next day and that thing is loaded with mummy chalks. It's so definitely interesting.
Yeah, but yeah, I also thought it was pretty cool, like their hardiness, you know, because some mm-hmm. of those sites we sampled were pretty, you know, I mean, there was one like directly in a marina, probably not
yeah
absolutely ideal water quality, but mm-hmm. but there they were just living their best life.
Yeah, though that is totally true. Like there were some spots where I felt like just the fluctuation and like how saline the water is was humongous. And then some of the like marshy areas looked like they were probably just really hot, you know, like it's oh, in yeah. direct sunlight and these little fish are just like, whatever, I'm fine. This suits me. It's fascinating. I'm like, I don't think I could handle sitting in there that long, but apparently for them it is just fine. And yeah, in the marina water and stuff, there was one site where we were, I think, right next to like an auto parts store or something like that too. Yeah. And it was like right by yeah. the road. I'm like, I'm sure there's all sorts of weird runoff and stuff in this pond, but apparently it's fine.
I know that they loved it there.
Yeah, exactly. They're thriving. Small but mighty, I guess, yes. is probably the tagline for mummy chogs.
Yeah. Well, what I'm getting from this conversation is that you and I need to do a mummy chog project.
Yeah, I think so. I support it. I'm 100% down.
I'm in.
Just let me finish my PhD first.
Yes. We will let you finish that.
Gonna get that done. You know, just a small obstacle.
Yeah.
The mummy chog plan. That'd be great. Maybe we could do like a mummy chog feature episode sometime or something.
That'd be so fun. I would love that.
Yeah, we'll have to workshop that plan. I want to keep okay. that in mind because I just, they need to be appreciated for what they are, not just good bait. More than that.
they do. They deserve more respect.
Exactly. I will still use them as bait, but like I care about them.
So, I do too, but
yeah.
I'm gonna get you a Got Mummy Chog shirt. I found one on Amazon. Yes.
Oh, that, I would love that.
Well, I didn't know you were such a fan of them. You need one.
Yeah, I know. We can be the fan club. It's just the yeah. two of us. There will be more at some point.
We'll find more.
We'll make it happen. Everyone yeah. who listens to the podcast, they will join.
Yes.
Love it. I could keep talking about mummy chugs forever, apparently, as could you, but we should probably move yes. on for everyone else's okay. sake.
Okay.
So you got up to some other stuff at CMS, though. Right.
Yes.
Because you came back for, I think, another summer.
Two I did, in a row. Yeah.
Okay, cool. If you could walk me through what you did, I guess, in your second summer as a summer fellow, if I got that yes. right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You got that right. So my second summer and my last summer, it was very bittersweet. Mm-hmm. I analyzed discard mortality in dolphin fish.
Oh, awesome. That's yeah. a fun fish.
Oh, yes, they are. They like live hard, die young, like they are
yeah
but so much fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, basically kind of the rationale behind this project was that North Carolina doesn't have a minimum size limit for yeah. dolphin. Mm-hmm. But several other states in the Southeast do. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure like South Carolina and Georgia do. That's off the top of my head. I need to fact check that.
Yeah, no, all good.
But So basically, this project involved looking at different hooking locations in dolphin fish and then determining the discard mortality rates for each hooking location.
Gotcha.
So basically, the idea was if North Carolina did impose a minimum size limit and, you know, a fisherman caught a fish that had to be discarded legally, what was yeah. this fish's chances of survival based on its hooking locations? And that was pretty fun. We spent a lot of time, Chloe Michaels, she spent yeah. that summer with me. We spent a lot of time on the fish cutting dock, getting mm-hmm. fish that a lot of the charter boats brought in, a lot of time extracting hooks and finding injuries. It was really interesting. Yeah. And basically we found that, gut and throat hooking typically had the highest mortality rate. And she did like a whole nother project on eye hooking, which was really interesting.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, it was a really fun project. It was really interesting. Mahi also have a very special place in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
We also did a little bit of field work where, so we looked at fish that had already been killed, that we really had to look at the hooking location from there. But then we also did some tank studies. So basically, the crew at Seamast built this giant live well. like way too big to be real.
Yeah.
And we brought it on a charter boat and we would hook a fish and then we would monitor the fish in the live well for a few minutes and see how it did, you know, like look and see if it was bleeding, stuff like that. And then if it was in good condition, you know, we'd let it go and see how it did after we let it go. And that was really cool. I do remember someone walking by the live well at Seamast one time and asking what it was for. And I'm like, oh, it's a live well for mahi. And they're like,
like, no, it's not. It's a swimming pool. And you're like,
They thought I was joking. And I'm like, no.
We're serious. We're bringing this on a boat. That's so funny.
Cause
how cool though.
You know, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, genius, but crazy.
Yeah. I mean, but it solves the problem of being able to observe them immediately after release. So.
Yeah, I mean, it just blew my mind. I didn't know that that was even an option.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, sometimes the best solutions are kind of the most off the wall and creative. I feel like in fisheries, that's often a thing as well, as people just like engineer the craziest solution. Like, I've come up with it. Here we go. And it works, you know, can be like a great way to get a new look at something. So that's really cool. Yeah. I wonder if they still have that, what they'd use that for now.
I really hope that they do. I'd be so sad if they didn't
just
have
like
it.
A jacuzzi.
It probably is.
Sold it.
It was big enough to be one.
That's awesome.
It was so cool. Like I said, very lucky to be a part of that.
I mean, it's just like I said before already, probably at least three times. It's just like Seamast is a great place to get your start. That is for sure.
It really is. It's, I don't even have words. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Well, cool. I don't know if you have anything else on that one, because we can talk more about it if you'd like, but if not, I'd love to kind of get into what you're doing for your current research, since I really don't know, I guess, as much about that. And I'm curious to just sort of hear how it's been going and what you've been working on.
So basically my current research has two main parts. So the first is to estimate maturity schedules and fecundity for non-native catfish in the Kafue River. And the second is attempting to improve the prey identification in their stomachs and that same non-native catfish through DNA barcoding. And I'm looking particularly at flathead catfish, so Pylodictis olivieris. That's my main fish now.
Nice.
Yeah. But so at least for the first part, I guess, for the maturity part, there have been historic studies on flathead catfish, but they've been more limited to macroscopic inspection in their native range as far as reproduction goes. And in macroscopic, while it's helpful, it's definitely good when, you know, it's not as expensive. It's a little bit less, I guess, time inducive, but it's not the most accurate. So we wanted to do a detailed histological look at the individual ovaries and oocytes. So, and that also hadn't been done before, especially for this non-native population. So from previous research, we had a pretty good idea about like peak spawning seasons. So when we were sampling, we tried to give a pretty wide berth to capture like the true spawning season. We really wanted to see fish that were, you know, not quite mature yet, in contrast with those fish that were basically, you know, ready to pop.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. So basically we used low frequency electrofishing. We started sampling in late March. And are you familiar with low frequency?
So I've done electrofishing one time, just as like a volunteer with Cornell has like a field station on Oneida Lake up in New York. And so I helped out. They do this really long standing electrofishing survey. But it was that one, it's like from a boat and we had the you know, wires hanging in the water. Again, I'm making gestures even though I'm on a podcast.
I understand your gestures though.
But yeah, so I have some experience, I guess, with electrofishing, but I don't know if it's the same kind that you guys were using.
So it actually is. And I was, so I didn't have any previous experience with electrofishing until I started this project.
Yeah.
And so I was surprised because pretty much the only thing I had kind of in my head as previous knowledge of electrofishing was the backpack shocking.
Yeah, I know. Cause that's, I feel like what most people think of. I'm like,
yeah.
Cause it looks like Ghostbusters or something. It's like a more iconic image, you know, instead of just pontoon boat. Yeah,
no, it definitely does. And so then, you know, my advisor is like, here's your boat. And I'm like, what do I do with that? So it was definitely fun to learn how to do that. That was a really fun experience. And then basically we would just, well, you know, if you've done it, but we basically just wait until the stunned fish came up to the surface. And then it was like a race against time to get them. For a long time in the lab, that was kind of like the most sought after job just because it was so fun. Everyone wanted to be the netter.
No, it's so much fun. It feels like some sort of, like almost like an old timey video game or something, like Brick Breaker or whatever. You know, it's like Pong. There's like a thingy, a platform, making more gestures on a podcast, and there's a ball, and you're trying like intercept it, like bounce.
Okay, I know.
Like it's that sort of like entertaining thing where you can just get so engrossed in it. You're just like, oh, I'm gonna scoop all these fish. Watch me go. It's so much fun.
Oh, definitely. And it definitely turned into a competition because we had the boat and the chase boat. And and we always joke because much to my dismay, I really wanted to have the lab record for the biggest catfish caught. But my mentor does hold it. Fred Scharf holds the lab record for the biggest catfish. I believe it came in at like 54 pounds. I know. And I got one that was like, we got two really big ones the same day and I was convinced that I was going to win. I was so excited. And then we weighed them and he's like, nope, I win. But
I mean, that's a big fish, but
a big fish, but it basically became kind of the challenge of like who could get the biggest fish and who could get there the fastest, which was really fun. It made field work more fun.
Some healthy competition, you know, makes things go faster.
Oh, definitely. So once we got through the fun field work part, basically we just take them back to the lab and the stomachs and the ovaries were what I was most interested in. So for the ovaries, basically I did egg counts. I used the gravimetric method for fecundity. And then eventually I had histology slides made. So I'm currently in the process of going through all the histology slides and staging individual oocytes within the ovary. But it's been really cool just to, you know, mark each fish with their highest stage of maturity. And we've actually seen a lot of POFs in them. So I'm hoping.
So
I was really excited when I saw them. So I'm really hoping that I can further classify the fish into, you know, really small spawning windows. So that would be really cool if that works out.
That's so exciting. Yeah. I've never had any past experience with histology or any of that stuff, but I am impressed by people's skills.
Well, I got lucky. I was at DMF. I was supposed to be there for like 2 weeks to clean bottles and then they gave me the opportunity to learn. I was there for 2 years. So
shout out
to DMF in Morehead City.
I think I skipped over that, which is like not my best work as a podcast host, but hey.
You do great work as a podcast host.
Thank you. I try. But yeah, that is a great point.
I owe all my knowledge of this to them. So
yeah. No, that's so excellent. I mean, just being able to get that sort of hands-on experience, especially for 2 years straight. Like, that's great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it was never something that had even kind of crossed my radar. I mean, mm-hmm. Even though I had been involved in previous fisheries research, that was not something that I had ever shown an interest in or had even really thought about.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of just kismet, I guess, when they got me onto it and I'm like, wow, I kind of love this.
So. Yeah, no, that's so great that you found something that got you really excited. And it's awesome that you were able to take it and bring that experience forward into, you know, your grad school projects. So that's really
I got really lucky out. With that one. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Oh, and then we have our diet work mm-hmm. with the flatheads. And that's also been really interesting. That's also a very new thing for me. I did not have any experience in DNA barcoding, mm-hmm. but it has been the coolest thing to learn. So basically flatheads, as far as our diet work goes, we know that they pose a really large threat to native species.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have any natural predators. Their gape size is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And basically after about 300 millimeters in length, they become completely piscivorous. So they will eat anything they can get their hands on.
Yeah.
So real problem.
It's like a vacuum cleaner. Yeah, just coming through, sucking up fish.
They really are. I mean, I swear, I've seen some where I'm like, if I was pretty sure it would try to eat me.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Like,
I mean, that 50 some pounder,
or at least like tug on my foot or something. Catfish are shady. but so basically, because they eat everything in sight, we really want to have a good idea of what they're eating. And we found out, so actually the researcher who was in this lab before me, David Bukowski, he did a thing where he just looked at stomach contents outright. And unfortunately he found that a lot of these stomach contents, they couldn't be identified because the catfish, their prey is really like masticated by the time it gets to their stomach, and that digest really quickly. So basically when you open it up, the only way you're going to find something that's morphologically identifiable is if it just ate it. And you know that we're not that lucky all the time.
Yeah. And especially, you know, if they're eating like crazy, I'm sure there's a bunch in there already that's been digesting, even if you do get some recently ingested stuff.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, and even, you know, we find quite a bit of blue catfish in there, but those are only really easily identifiable because of their spines.
Yeah.
So it can be hard. So basically now our method is just to go through, I kind of identify the separate chunks of digested fish and try to get, you know, as close to the muscle as I can, rinse mm-hmm. it off real well, try to get any kind of residual DNA from those stomach juices off it. And then I'm able to send it off to a lab. I use primers to amplify certain parts of the DNA.
Yeah.
But then I send it off to a lab and they send me back a sequence, and then I can compare it against BLAST and hopefully get an accurate idea of what that fish is.
That's so neat.
It's very cool. It's been a long journey. I've been really lucky to have so many people at UNCW and at Penn State, where one of my committee members is, just helped me so much in this process because it was something I was so unskilled at.
Yeah, it's like so foreign to you, but then that's great though to have mentors who can guide you along, get you more comfortable with it.
I've been so lucky. I've had such helpful people. It's mm-hmm. like it wouldn't have been possible without them.
Yeah, that's such a neat technique, I guess, because it is hard when you're trying to figure out what all that mush in there is.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, maybe for people listening who haven't had the joy of cutting into a fish stomach and looking at what's in there, it's really something. It's lots of indistinguishable goo and some like bones and stuff. Yeah. Sometimes something that vaguely looks like a fish.
Yeah.
Which is exciting.
That was like the perfect description.
I've heard like If you find like otoliths or something in the stomach, you can use those to try and ID what was in there.
We have found some of those.
That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, we have found some of those. They have not been identified yet. But, you know, hopefully that's the next step.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's so neat. Yeah. Very cool. I guess, where do you kind of see, once you've gotten through, you know, all of this work, is there kind of like an impact you see your project having or something you'd like to help answer or solve? I know you kind of alluded to the fact that they're, you know, the species that rolls up and starts eating everything.
Like yeah.
That's probably the problem of interest. But yeah, just if there's anything else you have to add on that.
I mean, I guess the biggest goal would really just be to help management, to help better manage how these fish are, taken out of the system, whether or not there are rules for putting them back in the system. I know that this year, I'm pretty sure the record for both flathead and blue catfish was broken this year in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. But I know at least the blue cat was actually put back in the river.
Wow.
So I'm sure that with better information, the management implications could be greater, you know, in helping to kind of keep this species a little bit more curtailed in their impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all I have for questions about your current research. But if there's any other points or fun stories you have to share, happy to hear them. If not, we can move on to my next question.
I can give one last story.
Yeah, I love more catfish stories or field work stories or whatever. Happy to hear it.
Okay, my last story is that, so again, this is the first time I've ever worked with a catfish, or really anything like a catfish.
Yeah.
So when I first started field work, how I said that my ego got kind of dropped with how strong catfish were.
Yeah.
There was a specific incident.
Yeah.
This is the tea. This is when I worried everyone on the boat.
Good stuff.
So I didn't realize, you know, cause you see people noodling. Well, anyway, I went to pick up a catfish that we had brought on the boat. And instead of really picking it up, like I probably should have, I stuck my whole hand in its mouth, you know, to try to like scoop it up, you know, like by its mouth. Yep. So only my thumb was out, and that thing did like an alligator death roll, which I wasn't expecting.
Like, that's a surprise.
Yeah, didn't know they did that. Now I do.
Yeah, learned from experience.
Yeah. So that was when I realized that yes, the catfish are stronger than me, and I should be more respectful.
Yeah, you're like, oh, I see.
Yes.
I mean, I guess that is when you're working with the new fish, you don't know. Turns out they can be pretty strong.
I've also had a few times where I've gone to net a fish and it's gone up and down several times, and it took me about 6 tries to net the fish. That was not my finest moment.
I feel like netting is an art. It's not the easiest thing. Like, you'd think it would be so simple.
It is an art. It's true. We had one tech who was a prodigy at it. I don't think anyone could beat him. I am convinced he is the best at it, and I don't think anyone can tell me otherwise.
Yeah. Deserves a trophy.
He does. Yes.
Yeah. I think I was mediocre at best when I tried to net. I got some fish, but there were a couple, like we were netting in an Ida Lake, maybe like big fat carp pop up. I don't know if I could scoop that. It was pretty fun though. You get better at it. It's a practice thing, but yeah, some people, they're good. I'm like, man.
I'd like to say I think I'm fairly good at it. It was mostly when the fish would kind of come up, and then they had this really bad habit of rolling down and then going on the other side of the boat. So I basically looked like the Three Stooges going from one side to the other. With the 12-foot handle.
I guess that's the other thing probably to emphasize if people haven't had the joy of doing this.
Very long net.
Electrofishing. If you haven't gotten to get into a stomach or electrofish, you should try both. They're so fun. But like that pole is crazy long, which is nice because, you know, you can reach things, but it's also probably the least convenient thing to try and move around with. It's like you're jousting or something.
I am very surprised that none of us ever got like accidentally hit in the head.
Yeah.
So I consider that a real win.
I think that's a success, you know?
Yeah.
Got the fish in the boat. No one got a concussion. It sounds like a win to me.
Thank you.
Yep. You just picked up a catfish by the mouth, but hey, that's all right.
First time mistake. Never made it again.
Yep. You're like, oh, I see. I didn't realize I should not have done that.
Definitely
great.
Learning experience.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, the best way to learn is by doing, I guess.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone does have, you know, some fun field stories like that where you're like, yeah, I realized I'd made a mistake, but
you realized you made the mistake usually when it's a little too late.
Yeah, exactly. So funny. And then I guess I was also wondering, in addition to, you know, your grad school work and what you've been up to with that, is there anything else that you've kind of been doing with your time? Any hobbies or other fun stuff? I know, you know, it's funny to ask grad students about hobbies and then expect them to actually have free time at all. So if you don't have an answer, that's fine.
Recently, I've been trying to make some time to kind of do non-school stuff because, you know, work-life balance.
It's important. Hard to achieve, but yes. Important.
It is. I guess recently I have two cats. They take up a lot of my time. Mm-hmm. Basically children.
Yes,
anyone who has children is like, no, Claire, they're not,
they're like very different, but
but they're my children. But so I hang out with them a lot. They're good study buddies. I also really enjoy doing watercolor. So I've been trying to do that more.
Oh, that's so cool.
Thanks. I only paint fish. So,
hey, that's all right. You know, you've got an interest.
So I exclusively paint fish. Actually, really recently, I've just been trying to make a point to walk on the beach. You know, like the weather's really nice. It's a little cooler and it's less crowded. So that's recent, but I've been trying to like make time, you know, like maybe once a week in the morning to go walk on the beach and just have, you know, like a calm little walk. And that's been really nice.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very cool. I think that's all I had written up for you in terms of questions, but we have the same 5 questions that we ask every guest. So to start off, could you please tell me, what is your favorite fish?
I have multiple, but I think the winner is the mako shark.
Nice. Why? What is your rationale behind the mako being your favorite? Other than that, they're just objectively cool and really speedy.
You're right. They are objectively cool and really speedy. So the speed gets me. I feel like I've seen several videos where they're just like very sly in the ocean. Like they just kind of pop out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I just find that to be like a really interesting hunting technique, which I'm like, you know, good for them. Mm-hmm. And also, I just think they look really cool. Like they have those giant eyes.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, like almost that purple, like iridescent-y skin. Mm-hmm. I just think they're a really cool shark. Like, you know, and I love all sharks, and the great white shark is cool, but I feel like the mako is like its stealthier cousin. Mm-hmm. So
true. That is a good one. Yeah.
That's my love behind the mako shark.
They look like if you wanted like a cool, like cinematic shark, that's the one that you should
they
pick.
Really,
even though, you know, really obviously great whites get all the hype, but
yeah. Well, cool I feel looking. Like they have kind of that scary shark look, you know, which like
There's definitely something like kind of crazed with like the big eyeballs.
Yeah.
They were just like, woohoo. That was the other thing too, I guess. And I don't have a source for this. I should probably like look it up, but I thought I saw something and it was just some like study that got thrown out there and like, you know, just in random news media where they said that Mako's like rock music or something like that, or that they were attracted to AC/DC. I could be completely making that up, but I could have sworn that it wasn't a dream and I read something. They were like playing AC/DC underwater to see if Mako sharks would show up.
That makes me love them even more.
So we'll have to see whether that's actually true. But I'm if it is, it's a fun fact. They like to rock out, so that's cool. Yeah, I mean that kind of adds to their whole energy though, if they've got the crazy eyes and they, you know,
they really are like they seem like the anarchists of the ocean.
Yeah. I love that. Nice. Yeah, that's a solid reasoning right there. That's a good favorite fish. Sweet. Well, I guess go on to the next one. So this is a hard one, but it's okay. What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I think probably my favorite memory, it wasn't any research that I was involved in, but I did the shark survey at the UNC lab when I was in Moorhead. And the day that I went, we happened to pull up an 8-foot tiger shark.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and it was my first time seeing one in person. Yeah. And this is a podcast, you can't see me grinning like an absolute idiot, but it still brings the biggest smile to my face. I think it was one of the best days I've ever had. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I'm sure that was just like such a exciting surprise too, to like see that emerge out of the water. Cause that's the cool thing, I feel like, with marine science and fishery science, is you're working with all this stuff that you can't see and it's hidden, right? And then you know, you're pulling stuff up and it's always fun to see what's on the other end of like the line or what's in the net, but sometimes you get crazy things and that's so cool. Well, I feel like I would be screaming.
It honestly took everything in my being to not completely turn into like a puddle on the floor. I'm pretty sure like I did have some tears of joy that I kind of like tried to cover up. But
you're like, I'm very professional. This is fine. I've seen sharks before. It's all right. Whatever.
Because I was taking data, you know, like I had the notebook and I'm pretty sure at some point I just kind of had to like hide half my face because I was grinning so hard. But that was pretty cool, especially because I was taking data, so I wasn't like pulling in the line or anything. So we were getting like, you know, all these little sandbars, which are really cute. But then, you know, the guys were like, oh, like something big is on here. Mm-hmm. And the first thing we saw was that tail. And it was just so, you know, it was kind of like the ultimate, you know, like slow-mo thing, because the only thing you saw was the tail, and the tail was already so big that you just knew whatever they brought out was going to be.
Yeah, that's so
monstrous. So,
oh man, did it like kind of splash around or anything like that too? Because I feel like when sharks like slap their tails, it's crazy the force that, you know, they can put out.
It was. I was honestly kind of surprised because it was. I mean, it did thrash around a bit, but it wasn't as aggressive as I would be if I was being pulled out of my
makes sense. It's sort of like
but it was so big, and so, you know, they used like the big like lifting chain to pull it up. It did take a couple bites at one of the people who was pulling up like it was very close, and you know, they're like telling all the students to stay back. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I think was probably the coolest was that, you know, we'd been handling these sandbar sharks all day.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of like, they don't really care that you're handling them.
You know, like, they're just going with it. There. That's so funny.
But we pulled up this female, and you know, once we got her on the deck and she was staying still, her eyes were just like so, you know, they followed you everywhere. So to go from like this little sandbar that like did not care what was happening to it, it was like, you can hold me, it's fine. To have this, you know, like just giant creature just like watching everyone and everything. Like you could tell that a lot was going on, you know?
Yeah.
Behind those eyes. That was really cool.
That's so neat, man.
Yeah.
I guess we can move on to the next question. Okay. 3 out of 5 for the final 5 questions. So if you could pick a dream job and or the location that you'd like for this dream job, what would it be?
I'm gonna go by location first. I would love to live in the Lofoten Islands in Norway. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong.
That's cool. So what makes you, I guess, want to go to Norway? What's the draw?
I just saw pictures of it, and you know, it looks like something out of a storybook. I mean, it's gorgeous. The landscape is amazing. I think it's really cool how they manage some of their natural resources. I specifically looked at Lofoten because it was a small fishing village, and I thought that was really cool. I think they do like a lot of cod fishing up there. So if I'm going by location, then I guess my dream job would be something doing research with cod up there. And they also surf there, which I think is fun because like it's so cold, but they still go surfing. I wonder
how thick those wetsuits are, man.
They have to be super thick, but I'd still be willing to try it.
That's so cool though. I love that plan. Well, if you do go, let me know. I would like to come. I think that would be fun. Roll on to the next question. If money was no issue, what is one project that you would want to work on?
I would just follow Blue Marlin around the world.
Yeah. Wait, I mean, I feel like for something like that, where it's just so costly, you know, to track and understand the movement of an animal like that. That's a good choice. You're like, I have all the money I need. Hypothetical question. I'll just follow them around and find out what they're up to. It's a good point.
If I could find someone to fund it, I would follow Blue Marlin wherever it goes.
Yeah, I like that plan. That's awesome. Yeah, okay, because it is so difficult when you get to the point where you're dealing with something with that high a migratory capacity and trying to get any sort of reliable, high resolution, retrievable data. It's a struggle.
Like at some point, I'd love to do like a full histology study on Blue Marlin. Like that would be my bag. Again, not super scientifically feasible, but
if it were possible,
I'd love that. I really love that question, but because I really did, I sat down and I was like, if I could, what would I do?
Yeah, it's a good thinker. Every time I ask, I'm like, what would I say? I'm not sure.
Just gotta have like a list of good ideas.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that brings us to the last question of the interview, sadly. As much as I would like to continue talking for a whole Friday night,
I know.
Should probably let you do things since you're busy. If there was one point or principle that you could magically program into everyone's head, what would it be?
I think I would say, don't be afraid to ask for opportunities.
That's a great one.
Thanks. I just think that a lot of times, but because I totally deal with it too. I think that a lot of times you might want to do something and you might put off asking because you think that, you know, I mean, and especially, I think it goes for a lot of areas of life, but I guess specifically with research, you know, I think there were a lot of times where I was afraid to ask to do something because I was going to get told no, you know, or something like that. But when I ended up asking, people are generally, and I think usually, very open to giving you opportunities when you ask. Like I've never had someone, you know, give me an answer where they're like, no, you cannot do that. How dare you ask? So I would say be open to getting out of your comfort zone and asking to help with things, and also doing things that you wouldn't think that you'd be interested in, because I think that a lot of times mm-hmm. you find stuff that you never would have thought would gauge your interest. And you know, if you don't try, you don't know. And also, like, even as a little tangent off of that, I would say show up to like anything, even if you think it's like the most boring thing in the world. I mean, there were mornings at CMAS where someone would say, hey, I need help moving boxes. And you know, it's 6 a.m. it's freezing. Does anyone really want to show up at 6 a.m. to move boxes? Not really. But I would show up, and in the next hour I would be handling cold stunned sea turtles. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's just amazing the fact that like people notice when you show up and they appreciate it. And so I think that any opportunity you have to help at all will literally almost always lead to something great, because I think that people appreciate you showing up and putting in effort and putting in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really true. That's a great point. Awesome. Well, that is all I have for you. That's, I think, a great point to leave off on. But thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm really glad that we were able to do this. And it was so fun for me just to hear what you've been up to.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. We'll have to do that Mummy Chag episode. If you would like to get in touch with Claire, you can reach her by email at pelletier.claire.b@gmail.com. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me or the other hosts on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at fisheriespod, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. Don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon, or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Hannah. Thank you for listening to the 153rd episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, don't be afraid to put yourself out there and try new things.